Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're already starting nearly an hour late, and I don't want to get much later than that. This is the House Committee on Revenue. Today is Thursday, the 19th of May. we've got a number of bills set for public hearing and possible work session. Representative Riley and I are going to form, and Representative Galizio, to my right and to my left, are going to form a subcommittee of the Committee on House Committee on Revenue, and we'll begin this afternoon by hearing House Bill 3143 in a public hearing. Mary, can you please?
That's the 3143A engrossed. Section 2 of it authorizes the Department of Economic and Community Development to approve designation of up to 10 additional urban and non-urban enterprise zones, raising the limit up to 59 enterprise zones. It also allows taxing districts to elect not to participate in zone designation, and it requires that the applicant for designation submit to the department or the director of the department a list of the special districts that have not elected to participate in the designation of a zone. That is, I've given you the amendment or the 3143 amendment, and then I have listed in a summary sheet several other amendments that I can go through just to show you the differences.
Why don't we take these one at a time as we come forward, and we'll have the various witnesses testify on behalf of what it is that their amendment, and they can identify that should they have copies of them. So, first person forward is Ed Metcalf, chair of the the Coquille Indian Tribe. Ed, welcome. Thank you. It's good to have you here. Do you have someone that's with you that you need to bring up?
Yeah.
I'm going to bring those two handsome gentlemen by you.
The tribes want to deal with those two amendments.
You can bring Brad if you wanted, but I was going to hope that you'd bring that other handsome gentleman. No, that's fine. Thank you, Ed, for coming. I appreciate your being here today and the good work that you're doing on behalf of our friends of the Coquille in Coos County.
Chair Butler and members of the Revenue Committee, my name is Ed Metcalf, and I'm chairman of the Coquille Indian Tribe, which is headquartered at 3050 Tremont in North Bend, Oregon. And I want to thank the House Revenue Committee for giving me this opportunity to make the Coquille Tribe support for House Bill 3143, containing amendments making reservation enterprise zones more accessible and useful to the Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes. Today, the tribe asks you to approve the deletion of ORS 285C-306D, which imposes unnecessary burdens on the long-term development of Oregon tribal reservation lands. This subsection limits the Reservation Enterprise Zone Program to reservations that have a population density of no more than 15 persons per square mile. To my knowledge, only one of Oregon's 9 reservations meet this restrictive definition. Oregon law creates 2 types of enterprises zone, one specifically for Oregon tribal reservation lands held in trust by the U.S. government, which I'll call reservation enterprise zones, and one for all types of lands, which I'll call state enterprise zones. To be eligible as a state enterprise zone, an area must meet certain economic hardship requirements, namely certain medium income and unemployment thresholds. ORS 285C-306 creates virtually the same qualifications for reservation enterprise zones. However, ORS 285-306 has one major difference. ORS 285C-306D states that Oregon reservation areas only qualify if they have a population density of no more than 15 persons per square mile. No companion population requirements exist for state enterprise zones. The proposed amendments would remove this population density requirement from ORS 285C-306, yielding essentially the same qualifications for both state and reservation enterprise zones. These population density requirements almost nullify the effectiveness of Oregon's reservation enterprise zone program. To my knowledge, only one tribal reservation in Umatilla Tribe qualifies under the current definition. Ironically, all of Oregon's restored tribes do not qualify because they lost all their lands during the now repudiated federal termination policy. If you have visited any of Oregon's reservations, you know that we are greatly underserved by businesses and investment and yet are poised to be an emerging Oregon market. The Coquel tribe feel compelled to create reservation-based business to serve and employ the members of not only our tribe, but our entire community. However, ORS 285C-306D effectively creates an unequal playing field and fails to allow any state tax incentive for business investment on a reservation. However, we know of no current reservation enterprise zones that is up and running. It is difficult for us to predict the economic consequences of this change. However, the tribe does not anticipate a need to use the reservation enterprise zone until sometime in 2008 at the soonest. And Tribal Attorney Brett Kinney and I would be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ed. You're testifying on behalf of the A9, which are dated today, the A9 amendments, which would remove the population density of 15 persons. What is the population density per square mile of your your reservation, Ed, of the Coquille?
Right now it's...
Brett, identify yourself with the record.
I'm sorry, Sheriff Butler. I'm Brett Kinney. I'm the tribal attorney for the Coquille Indian Tribe. And our density is about twice that if you take into account the Coquille Forest. If you don't take into account the 2,600-acre Coquille Forest, it's much, much denser than that.
Okay. So by removing that density population issue, then it's assumed that other tribes could meet the other high bars that you've got to jump through for the enterprise zones at some point in time. Okay. Questions of either Brett or Chair Metcalf? It's my great pleasure to work with Chair Metcalf. He's a fine man, a great stalwart in the community, and I appreciate your taking the time out of your other activities today, Ed, to come on. Thank you very much. If there's no further questions, thank you. And then we'll go on to...
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you. Terry Connolly. Jack Listleman. Terry, you're from Eugene Chamber of Commerce. Which amendment are you here to testify on behalf of?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Terry Connolly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. My comments are actually that I've submitted more just general support for House Bill 3143 with the concept to expand the number of enterprise zones allowed in the state of Oregon. And so that's the position of the Chamber of Commerce. Briefly, I won't read verbatim the written comments I'm submitting. We believe that enterprise zones are a responsible economic development tool. And in our situation in Eugene, previously we had an enterprise zone from 1987 till 1997. It was very successful. In fact, it was probably one of the more successful ones in the state of Oregon. Unfortunately, and much to the dismay of the chamber, we were disappointed to see our local officials at that time decide not to continue with an enterprise zone. And I think in the years since then, many of the skeptics at that time are starting to realize the benefits that have come to our community by the 57 companies that participated in the enterprise zone when we had one. And of those 57, 48 of those were existing Eugene businesses who chose to expand in our community. And so we believe this is a responsible economic development tool. It's an important tool because it is one of the few tools provided by the state of Oregon to assist local communities with economic development. And for those who are inclined to think this is a good tool, we believe it would just be beneficial to all communities in the state who desire this, whether they're large or small, urban or rural, to have access to this tool. And so the value of House Bill 3143 is it does increase the number of enterprise zones allowed in the state of Oregon, and we think that is a good thing, and we would hope this committee would approve this legislation. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you again for this opportunity to comment, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. And Jack, you're with the Eugene or Lane County.
I'm with the Lane Metro Partnership.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you go ahead and sign in?
Chair Butler, yes. Please. For the record, my name is Jack Esselman. I'm here today on behalf of the Lane Metro Partnership. I also have the distinct honor of carrying some testimony from your colleague, Representative Scott Brune, who in a fit of pragmatism is uprunning his business today. He asked that I briefly read some of his testimony into the record, so if it pleases the chair, I'll do that, and then I'll offer briefer still testimony on behalf of the Lane Metro Partnership.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee, I write in support of HB 3143. 3143 changes current Oregon statute by increasing the number of potential enterprise zones in the state by 10 to a new total of 59. Currently, there are areas in the state that would qualify for an enterprise zone designation that are ineligible due to the arbitrary state limit of 49. While a strong argument could be made to lift the numeric cap altogether, thereby allowing zones for all areas that qualify, the increase of 10 in this bill is a good compromise and would meet currently known demand. As to enterprise zones in general, I would argue that they serve as one of the very best tools that states and localities have in promoting economic development, capital investment, and job creation. Historically, enterprise zones have been used with good success by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to attack the problem of economic blight, most notably in urban inner cities. Enterprise zones were also the paramount economic development tool used in Britain by the Thatcher government during the 80s and 90s to reform and revitalize Britain's then anemic economy. To its great credit, the Blair government has maintained enterprise zones as a tool for growth and empowerment. Getting back to Oregon, I had the opportunity to speak with a city official from the Dalles. He made it clear to me that Google decided to invest in Oregon for three reasons: shovel-ready land, no sales tax, and property tax abatement from the enterprise zone. The Dalles official went on to tell me that had any one of these three attributes been missing, Google would have decided against investing in Oregon. Mr. Chair, committee, enterprise zones are an excellent tool for achieving economic growth, capital investment, and job creation that we all want. It's a tool that has worked for Oregon. I urge your continued support of enterprise zones by supporting House Bill 3143, Representative Scott Brune, House District 37. And then briefly on behalf of the Lane Metro Partnerships, first let me extend the regrets of Jack Roberts, the executive director of the partnership, who is in Eugene attending to a board meeting. I think Terry really hit on the need in Eugene for an enterprise zone, and in point of fact, Mr. Roberts advises me that they have a transaction that he believes with an enterprise zone they can secure that will equate to a $5 million investment in Eugene and 100 jobs. And he has a lack of confidence that they will be able to achieve that investment without the ability to get an enterprise zone. And because there are only 49 and there are only two coming up for renewal, and the communities that currently have the enterprise zones intend to renew them, they're absent this increase by statute. There is not a practical alternative for Eugene to avail itself of the enterprise zone investment tool. I just want to quote briefly some of Jack Roberts' testimony before the Trade and Economic Development Committee as it relates to the economic impact of this bill. And I quote, "I would not support enterprise zones even as an economic development tool if I thought that they impaired our ability to provide quality schools, effective law enforcement, good transportation linkages, and a stable and adequate social safety net. But unlike some other tax incentives, an enterprise zone does not reduce current tax receipts by $1. It does not remove a single dollar of property value off the current tax rolls. An enterprise zone simply delays the time when the value of new investment goes on the Oregon tax rolls in order to help encourage that new investment to, in fact, occur in Oregon. No doubt some of the investments that qualify for an enterprise zone will be made anyway, just as someone who buys a new refrigerator when a department store is offering no interest financing might have bought the refrigerator anyway. But retailers have learned that they can increase their total revenue by offering incentives like that. Similarly, so can communities. The enterprise zone, as structured in Oregon, helps us compete for new investment, new jobs, and traded sector industries, the kind of industries that every state and increasingly every country is trying to attract. For an example of how this affects the local tax base, I would point to Hynix, formerly known as Hyundai, a memory chip manufacturer in Eugene. They invested $1.2 million in a plant nearly a decade ago, when Eugene still had an enterprise zone. At that time, many people in the community complained about the lost tax receipts that the enterprise zone cost them. Yet today, after the initial enterprise zone period has elapsed and the initial investment is on the tax rolls, Hynix pays 6% of all property taxes collected in the city of Eugene and employs over 1,000 people in family wage jobs. So we would urge your support for enrolled House Bill 3143. I will make brief mention of the fact that contained in that bill is an opt-out for special districts. Now, as this bill came before the House Trade and Economic Development Committee, the Lane Metro Partnership took no position on that provision for the simple reason that Eugene has no special districts, and we are, as Mr. Shanley said, competing for an enterprise zone for Eugene. However, we found ourselves, as Representative Riley can relate to this committee, debating the pros and cons of the opt-out. We believe at the Lane Metro Partnership that we arrived at a reasonable compromise, an experiment with the opt-out that we can try for 2 years. It will have different effect in different communities. As I say, it'll be of no moment in Eugene. And in other communities, it may have a more significant impact, but we won't know that if the bill doesn't pass. And we are concerned that if the bill gets, if we get mired in this debate again before this committee, the practical effect of time will work against us, and we will lose the ability to create this economic development tool for Eugene, which we have a real practical use for at the present moment.
Thank you very much, Jack. Questions of these two gentlemen? Yes, Representative Hass.
Thank you. To either one of you, we have discussed this issue before, sometimes known as the burdens issue, which is to say the more enterprise zones you add, the more you dilute what you already have. Enterprise zones were created to help blighted areas or places like Burns where there is a real problem with jobs. And, Burns doesn't have the amenities that places like Eugene has, the airports, the infrastructure. So I think it's a good policy to give an incentive to a company to expand or relocate in Burns. If we give that same incentive to Eugene or somewhere else, we have taken away the appeal to relocate or expand in Burns, and we have done a disfavor to Burns. So can you help me out with that? Your Google explanation is illustrates my point. They went to the Dalles. They didn't go to Portland or Washington County, and they took advantage of this.
Yeah.
If we give these kind of incentives to Eugene and Portland, then it's unlikely that the Dalles or the Burns will be able to benefit.
Terry, do you want me to go ahead or?
Go ahead. Yeah, I will respond.
Okay. This was actually a very similar question to one posed by Representative Riley in the House Trade and Economic Development Committee, and let me try to give you the same response that I think was at least somewhat persuasive.
Well, he was concerned about Pines, not Burns.
And we testified to this very point in committee. I had the opportunity to work with Jack Roberts during my tenure at the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. We worked on about three transactions that added roughly 1,000 jobs to the Lane County area. And I would say, having both of us having seen these transactions come through over the transom, when a company comes in, it has its sights pretty well set on a location independent of these incentives. What the incentives allow you to do is compete with the sites in Washington or in Idaho or frequently in Singapore or Taipei. And I can't recall the Google situation with any particularity, but I don't think it was a situation where the Dalles was pitted against any other community in Oregon. I think we've seen, while in creating the enterprise zone, the goal was certainly to try to create a magnet for more distressed communities. In fact, I think the enterprise zone over time has emerged as an incentive for traded sector economic development in areas throughout the state. And in fact, the economic and blight distress requirements are on the books, so you have to meet that test, whether you're in Eugene or Washington County or what have you. And in some communities, it's just not going to be practical for them to adopt an enterprise zone because of the size of the investment. I mean, for example, a Washington County adopting an enterprise zone, I think, at least in some communities like Hillsborough, for example, an enterprise zone is not going to help you with a company like Intel Corporation. That's where we have the strategic investment program as an incentive for large-scale investments like this. What this is really designed to do is to attract that investment that's in the range of, you know, anywhere from $5 million on up to $50, $60 million. And frequently, Oregon communities find themselves competing with other communities outside of Oregon. So that would be our response to that.
Okay. Was that responsive, Representative? Further questions? Thank you very much. I just a couple of notes that I took from someone mentioned that, and because, Jack, you mentioned it relative to Jack Roberts, he said local governments should be totally sold on the enterprise zone or they should be allowed to opt out. Which means that enterprise zone promoters are not carrying their water very well. The second item was bringing those small local taxing districts such as fire, or sewer, ambulance, water, etc. to the table early and to get their buy-in may leave all of the parties to the entire zone better off when construction actually begins so that they'll all have services. So I think that's really looking at that problem from all angles at that point. Further questions? Thank you very much, Chair Jack. I appreciate it. Now we also will go ahead and excuse you, and we have Hasina Squires and Art Fish. And then following Hasina and Art is Doris Penwell and Tony Hyde. Hasina, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, an organization that represents approximately 900 special districts throughout the state of Oregon that provide services such as rural fire protection districts, parks and recreation, library, irrigation, port, sewer, water, about 26 different types of special districts. And we come to you today to support the A and Gross version of House Bill 3143. My testimony is being passed out. Some of you have already seen sections of this testimony as submitted to the Trade and Economic Development Committee.
It seems that the opt-out for local governments or for districts, special districts, is already included in the A and Gross. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, it is. It was inserted by the House Trade and Economic Development
have
Committee.
Have you seen the A-9?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I have seen the A-9s. I saw them shortly before the hearing.
Do you have any objection to the A-9? The A-9 is the one that would pull out the 15 persons per square mile requirement on reservations.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have no objection to the A-9s or the A-7s that are Senator or former Senator Messery's amendments.
Okay. All right.
In addition to that, if you'd like me to continue with with the other amendments briefly.
We're going to run out of time because
I'll be very brief.
Go ahead.
As you know, our association supports the provisions contained in sections 3 and 4, I believe, since we asked for them to be inserted in the House Trade and Economic Development Committee, simply permitting and leveling the playing field for all taxing districts to provide them with a permissive opt-out with a 60-day window prior to the designation of the zone, thereby giving the zone sponsor and the person seeking the property tax abatement the ability to know what they're getting up front. Districts are not automatically opted out under the provisions of the bill. They are they actually are required to take an affirmative action, so it's not they're out unless they ask They're not automatically out without taking any action. They actually must deliberate, discuss with the zone sponsor. We think that will help in the collaboration efforts between zone sponsors and other taxing districts and also the people seeking tax abatement. With respect to the A7s, we have no objection to that, and my understanding of those amendments are that they just simply narrow the number of
which ones, I'm sorry?
A7. Three new zones instead of 10 new zones under the provisions of the bill. Our issue isn't really with the number of new zones or however many. It's really about the property tax abatement. And the A8s, we do not support. The A8s eliminate the opt-out provisions that were inserted by the Trade and Economic Development Committee and replace it with a section that allows for the zone sponsor, when negotiating an agreement with the seeker of the tax abatement, to consider a fee-for-service payment. That sponsor, that's a negotiation that takes place with a zone sponsor, not with the special taxing districts that may be affected, and therefore we don't feel that that's, that solves our issue.
So you're opposing the A8s. You don't have an issue with the A7 and nor the A9.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. And
thank you very much.
I know you're pressed for time, so I will.
And I think deletes the opt-out provisions.
Oh, if the A7 does, and I just saw these, so if the A7 does delete the opt-out provisions, we would not support those. We don't mind if the number of zones, though, is reduced from 10 to 3. Or 10 to 1 or 10 to 9. It
doesn't. Okay.
Both the A7 and A8.
Okay. Art, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I will be brief. The staff is passing out our little blue booklet that we use for enterprise zones so that you have some general information for this and other legislation that involves them and other tax incentives, which we talk about in there. And, of course, I'd be happy to use that as the basis for answering any questions you have. The department is in favor of HB 3143, insofar as it creates some additional enterprise zone designations. There are perhaps a few communities out there that could use these in the near term, so that's great. We do favor the dash A8 amendments. Excuse me. First, I'd just like to note that we favor the dash A9 amendments, and I'll get that out of the way. We also do, you know, if it pleases the committee, favor either the dash A7s or the dash A8s. Briefly, they do reduce the number of potential new designations from 10 to 3. The second one, A8, does provide some additional instruction for doing what I know is commonly done in zones anyway, where there's a potential extension or additional consideration for a business at the local level. As you know, I can testify based on conversations this morning with a company and local officials in the chair's district of Ontario. And, you know, that people, you know, do address some of the issues if there's any immediate impacts during the short-term period while property is exempted, as it might affect the services provided by special districts. And I think that's a reasonably good thing to try to further instruct. We do feel there is a lot of good conversation, communication, and concern at the county and city level for those services, regardless of who provides them and who would be missing taxes for a short term on the property, as Mr. Isselman pointed out, is not existing revenue, but additional property. So, you know, to be quite clear, the department's position is that we would prefer opt-outs not be included with any new enterprise zone. It would create a handicap for those potential zones with respect to their working with businesses, mush up our marketing with respect to the enterprise zones in general, and possibly create an inequity between those zones when they're designated and they can't work something out with the special districts to avoid opt-outs, and all the other zones that don't have this, and that might lead to a steady creep of opt-outs for all the existing zones. So those are our concerns, and we ask for your consideration of them, but we do support some additional designations as well. Thank
okay.
you.
And the 3 and the dash 8 versus the bill as it presently stands at 10?
Yes. Both the dash 8 and the dash 7 would just say 3 new zones are available in the future. But the dash 8 has an additional language to hopefully get at a different solution here.
Okay.
Right. Thank you.
Further questions for either Senator Mark or Representative Ass?
Thank you. I guess this give you the question, why not just create an enterprise zone in the entire state?
Representative Haas, Chair Butler, members of the committee, I know you really want that, and I'm very happy to discuss that. In effect, what you would do if you want to do that was really just allow any business, and you have to set up some administrative framework for it, to have a 3 to 5 year exemption on its new property if it met certain requirements, like the 10% employment increase. I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, or you could allow every place. The thing is, it's limited to certain areas that want that based on the city and county governments and that meet certain economic criteria for it being needful of that kind of assistance. And so those are the basis that get you to the point of keeping it within discrete areas that are limited in some fashion. And indeed, of course, your point about dilution and so forth is valid, too. I mean, it doesn't make those areas that much that, they're not so special anymore. And part of the idea is to make them special both within the state and as a place in the state vis-a-vis the rest of the world. So, yes, that would be the best I can summarize it without getting into a long treatise.
Mr. Chair, I mean, we're up to 52 enterprise zones now. I mean, again, it makes it, Burns no longer has that advantage that we gave it. And so, if that's what we're going to do, why not just make the entire state an enterprise zone, and then we'll start some new, really special enterprise zone kind of marketing for Burns, and it just seems like that's the road we're going down.
Representative Haas, Chair Butler, members of the committee, I mean, that is perfectly fair observation, and I wouldn't dispute. We do have 49 zones, and, if you look on a map, they seem like they're everywhere, but they tend to be in a lot of smaller rural communities, so if you were to kind of do a population map, you would find that a huge amount of the population of the state is actually where there are fairly few enterprise zones. So if you look at it from that perspective and some of the industrial lands that are available in places that may or may not have an enterprise zone because they don't want one or they can't qualify, there is a lot of areas that don't have it. So it is still a fairly special thing, and there still are a lot of other challenges in those areas that have them where it is very useful. So, while I would say we are fairly well covered, it certainly is not a complete, a joke or anything. I mean, it still is fairly special. It's not just a given that you're going to have one. But your point is well taken.
Thank you.
Representative Escobar.
Yes. How many enterprise zones did we start the program with? And we're up to 49 now. There's only 240 cities in the whole state of Oregon. I think Representative Haas may have a very good point here. How many did we actually start with?
Representative Esquivel, Chair Butler, members of the committee, history, I like that. First of all, I should note that of the 49 zones, they are sponsored by most counties, one at least has one, and there's 89 cities that are sponsors of zones. So most zones have two, I think on average about 2.4 cities as a sponsor. So it's a kind of a community type of thing oftentimes. And that has been one of the best ways to help communities to get an enterprise zone is just by expanding one that's not so far away. So we've done that in Malheur County. We've done that in Lincoln County. I'm going to be out there on Tuesday giving a workshop. I'll have a workshop here on Friday tomorrow if you're all interested in learning more. But Bennett has 5 cities and the county in it. So, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. And then Portland sponsors, too. Now, we started out with 30. In 1985, the legislature provided for 30 zones that were designated by the governor. Governor Attia and Governor Goldschmidt appointed those 30. In 93, 7 more non-urban zones were allowed, and those were designated in a few years later. And then 10 were allowed in 1999, and that's when I first met Hasina. And
it's been going downhill every
time. Sorry about that. But the legislature worked through that, and 10 were allowed, and we created some rules and stuff to provide that whenever zones are designated or their boundaries change, there's a lot of local notification and communication with districts and stuff. And that was part of why Hasina jumped into my mind then. And those 10 have been designated. I think they were finally designated about 2001. And then we have one zone that's a reservation enterprise zone. There is one that you've heard before that has been created in Umatilla. And then secondly, the law since 85 has always said that if there's a federal enterprise zone, it may become a state zone as well. And that was done for the one that covers a great part of Josephine County. which was formerly a federal enterprise community. So that's how we got to 49. And yeah, I would agree, you know, I agree wholeheartedly. Representative Haas's point is very well taken about, you know, we've certainly grown to a fairly good level. And then, you know, how much farther do you want to go? Yeah.
The other
follow-up, Representative Sullivan.
Well, we started with 30. We're up to 49.
Correct.
And now we're going to break the 50 mark. And then we're contemplating opting out on these zones, which, in my opinion, waters the zone down for a appeal by letting the districts opt out on the tax part. Is that correct?
Representative Esquivel, Chair Butler, Mayor's Committee. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you have an opt-out, I mean, again, there's no guarantee that what special districts will actually exercise that option with one of these designations should the bill pass and so forth. But, yeah, I mean, it could reduce the tax benefit, property tax benefit, from anywhere from a 3 or 4 or 5% in most cases in many cases where there's very little special districts to what we see in a lot of places where it's as much as 20% of the tax levy. So, yeah, it's significant.
Representative Riley, you were part of the committee that adopted the opt-outs.
That's right. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, Jack Roberts was very convincing. Mm-hmm. And he came in and did a long, very convincing testimony, which included the opt-out. And his statement, which I fully support, was if the local jurisdictions who want this zone can't convince their partners, local partners, then they're probably not going to be very successful at managing this enterprise zone.
I think it's probably the case. Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you very kindly. Thanks for taking us down memory lane, too, there. Doris Penwell and Tony Hyde. Yeah, that's same year Representative Krupp and I. Jack, or Tony, you want to come and Doris?
We have Representative Nelson here.
I'm not sure that he's...
Representative Nelson?
I need a different bill.
Different bill?
Oh, the same bill? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Are you here on this bill? Well, you want to come forward, please, Representative? I beg your pardon. Stampede to apologize.
No, no.
Come forward. I beg your pardon.
No. I don't get to say no very often.
You learned that when you were two?
I did. Throwing a fit to get my way. Did it work, Mark?
Oh. It was pretty
fast. Okay.
Welcome, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Butler, and members of this committee. I am here in support of this bill. We did run it out of our Economic Development Department. I said we did two great things this year in that department. In fact, there's only two great things we did to promote development in this entire state, and they both came out of that committee. One was the e-commerce zone that Representative Butler moved back to committee last week because somebody didn't have the same document in their file that I had in mine, and this one. And, you know, in the last session we did ZIP. I mean, talk about needing jobs, you know, needing new industry. We did nothing. So our committee took that very, very seriously. And not only did we have, you know, 40,000 people needing jobs, we also had a huge slew of individuals coming home from the war who do not have jobs. So I felt that we couldn't have done anything better for this state than, you know, what the good Governor Attia and Goldschmidt, I guess, added on to it, did previously. My concern on this bill is I'm not crazy about the -9 amendment. I think we ought to keep the -8. You know, if we had 99 enterprise zones, who cares? When business thrives, communities survive. Just remember that. If businesses thrive, communities survive. And we're not going logging. Tell me, we're not getting a baseball team. What the heck are we doing? Really nothing. And I looked at the list from the employment agency in our committee. I have a conflict there. I'm very disappointed that we have so many individuals who have whose unemployment insurance has run out, and we've done zip to build new jobs. So I think this enterprise zone is one of the top two development bills that we've sent to the House, and we should support it. I mean, competition is good. If I could get Google from Representative Dallum, I'm going to. And, I'm tired of hearing about how sad his county is. And then he didn't even vote to help me with the Newburgh-Dundee bypass yesterday. So,
let's stay on 3143.
Oh, excuse me. No. My point.
To the bill.
I'm just kidding. You know, I lost 5 friends yesterday. But happened before.
For the record, the chair is one of them.
For the record, so was I.
Now, wait. Okay, hold it. Hold it there, Reverend Olson. But seriously, I don't understand your question, Representative Haas, as much as I like you. I don't know why we care. I frankly don't care if Clackamas has an enterprise zone or Klamath Falls or Burns or Pendleton. You know, I think what we're doing is basically giving those communities a college degree. You know, some knowledge, some opportunity to do something very competitive and build a future for those kids. I'm sick and tired of our kids leaving this state. We invest, you know, in them as parents and as communities, and then they leave because we have very little e-commerce beyond, you know, 2 companies. And I hear y'all all complain about this when I have, you know, heard it previously in the other sessions I've served in, however many, 8 I think it is now. But there should be no reason why we don't support this bill. There should be no reason why we don't give Yamhill County an opportunity to do the same thing that we're going to let, you know, Lebanon do. I mean, we can't, we have a transportation glitch. We can't move freight. So at least maybe we can, you know, send some internet letters or answer some calls, you know, through a call program. I think business is good. We better do something this session, and the more the better. I think it would be great competition to see which ones of us can bring in, you know, industry for our enterprise
zone.
And I'm working on it.
Representative Berger's recognized.
Yeah, thank you. Representative, is McMinnville,
does it have an enterprise
zone? Does it have one, or does it contemplate one?
It does not have one, but as soon as you sign this bill, I'll work on it. Sheridan does have one, really in the Sheridan that's in Representative Boquist's area, but it's in my county.
Okay.
Otherwise, we have none, and we need it. We have no business. We lost 6 major businesses because we can't move freight. I'm asking you to help us keep our Linfield College kids.
That's, and you have areas that have the high unemployment and the low family wage, 80% of the per capita median wage in your area there.
Representative Butler, we have a strange situation in that we have one city that does pretty well because it's in the wine business, and then we have 12 other little cities that are having a tough time.
Okay. Further questions of Representative Nelson? Thank you very much.
I just want to say, I've done my part for the wine business.
No, you can do a little better.
Thank you very much. Now, Doris and Tony, you want to come forward, please?
Shall I go first?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties. The counties have been in support of enterprise zones since the inception, and we have worked very closely with the department, city, and local service districts to make sure that they operate as well as they can at the local level. This bill, House Bill 3143, as it came out of the House Trade and Economic Development Committee, is something that the counties would love to support if it didn't have the opt-out language in it. We supported the 10 new zones. However, because of the opt-out language, with all the discussion that you've seen today, in our opinion, the main thing that it does is it drives a wedge between local partners, and you can walk away from the discussion rather than sitting down and talking and working out your problems and deciding whether to have an enterprise zone or not. So that is the main reason we do not want that kind of language in incentive legislation. But in order to meet that issue that's always out there, it's more philosophical than anything, I would say. In order to meet that, we are always willing to sit down and talk about beefing up language in the statute to be sure that the local partners are talking and taking care of service that is needed for businesses that locate. And therefore, the counties suggested the Dash 8 amendments to the bill, which reduced the number of zones, new zones, to three. It took out the opt-out language, and then it, as I said, beefed up the language that is actually already in the statute that allows the local partners, the sponsors, and the districts, the service districts, to talk about the kind of services that are needed for the businesses that locate there. County Commissioner Tony Hyde is here today. He works directly with these kinds of issues with his enterprise zone and businesses that locate, and I think he could speak as well as anyone to some of those kinds of issues. So,
Doris, is it your understanding that the opt-out provision for the special taxing districts would only be effective to the new zones that are applied applied for after the 49 zones?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Just so for the new zones that are designated. So it really creates
three
different kinds of zones.
Right. Is there anywhere from 3 to 10 zones that have opt-out provision or don't have?
The possibility,
okay.
Yes. That's
all
correct.
Right. So as the bill came over from the Trade and Economic Development, they're authorizing 10 additional urban, non-urban enterprise zones with opt-out provisions.
That's right.
So that would create a new type of urban
enterprise zone.
Okay.
Yes.
Of enterprise zone. Okay, Tony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tony Hyde, County Commissioner in Columbia County. First of all, I'd like to speak directly to what you just said, Representative Butler, because I think it's important to recognize that the existing enterprise zones have a life to them that's relatively short. And so this would, I understand, this would apply to any enterprise zones that expire and would then re-up, and they would be also subject to this, unless I'm mistaken.
So that's a question we need to get resolved because we'll get that resolved. But go ahead, Tony. We'll get that resolved.
I had not anticipated on testifying today, but it's interesting and almost fortuitous when I was talking to Doris about this bill coming up that tomorrow I'm sitting down with the fleet, or the fire chief in Clathkanai to talk about the timing of purchasing his new $100,000 pumper. That he's getting as a result of a company that came, frankly, as a direct result of an enterprise zone. A pumper, by the way, that he would not be getting if it was not for the fact that the company's there, and if it were not for the fact that we did an impact study prior to the company coming to really study the impacts of what the company was going to have and what kind of restrictions that the enterprise zone was going to put on special districts. And we do that as a regular course of business when we consider enterprise zones and when we are negotiating with companies prior to enterprise zones. My point is that we always consider special districts within the enterprise zone prior to signing an enterprise zone agreement. And Columbia County has, we are the sponsors of two enterprise zones. And a couple of cases in point of recent projects that would not have happened had it not been for enterprise zones is a $250 million paper machine that was just added to Fort James, now Georgia Pacific, in Clatsop County. And this is another anomaly in that we extended our enterprise zone into Clatsop County and included Clatsop County as a zone sponsor. Through special legislation just to make it available to Fort James so that we could get that paper machine. And I guarantee you, in the fight that we had with the state of Florida, had it not been for the enterprise zone that existed, we would not have that machine today. That machine would be in Florida. Additionally, Representative Haas, you had a good point about the blighted areas and how that competes. But I want to point out that enterprise zones are more than just for blighted areas. Enterprise zones, at least from my experience, and I've had a lot of experience with enterprise zones, really puts us on a global scale. It's not competing with areas within the state that we're worried about. It's putting us on a level so that we compete with other states. And that's really one of the issues. And the other is that I haven't heard a lot of talk about expansion and retention. And that's really one of the biggest pieces of an enterprise zone. Yes, it's great for attracting new industry, but in terms of incentives for an industry that's in existence now to expand or to stay there instead of move somewhere else, the enterprise zone is very valuable. So the expansion enterprise zones, we have two in Columbia County. And as far as having another enterprise zone competing against us, that's not an issue for us at all. I think enterprise zones, and keep in mind, they're only 12 miles long. So even with 49 or 52, you're not talking about a huge amount of area in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Questions for Tony or Doris? As I read the language, it appears that you're right, that when these, under Section 3, adds and makes a permanent change to the enterprise zones, that a local taxing district may elect not to participate. And so that makes that part of the enterprise zone. So it's my understanding that once the existing zones re-up, then you would have the opt-out provisions in all of the existing zones. Is that your understanding, Representative Riley?
It was not, but as I read it, I think it may be.
Okay.
I think we ought to have a...
Okay, let's... Mary, is that your understanding?
I originally thought that it only pertained to the new ones when we spoke this afternoon, and I said, well, the difficulty in doing the revenue impact is I don't know when they expire whether the existing older vintage zones would
have... I know that was the intent.
Okay. That was the intent?
That it was...
may not be the results.
That's right. But the intent was to make it only the new ones and not to...
These 10, and that was my understanding, was it was just these 10.
And that was the intent.
Hasina is shaking her head in the affirmative that it was only these 10. Jack Isselman is shaking his head in the affirmative. It was intended to be just these 10.
Right.
Okay. I'm not certain that that's what the bill does when I look at Section 3 on page 3. Mm-hmm. Section 4 of this act is added and made a part of, and it goes into the... and I have to have the ORS here in front of us to take a look at that. So let's get an opinion on that. Maybe we can get counsel to come back. Thank you very much. We appreciate your participation here today. You are advocating on behalf of the Dash 8. Do you have any problem with the Dash 9?
Not at all.
Okay.
Dash 7 is fine, too, except that I wanted to try to do something for service districts to be sure that they're included in the negotiations.
Okay. Who's the sponsor of the Dash 7?
It's the department,
OECD.
I believe.
OECD?
OECD.
Yeah.
And the Dash 8 is sponsored by the counties, and the Dash 9 by Coquille. Okay, we'll need to get some definition. And rather than take up any more time here in committee today, I think we'll just go ahead and wait for further definition. And it looks like we've got some folks with some work to do. So with that, I have no further sign-ups on House Bill 3143. We will close the public hearing on 3143. We'll open a public hearing on House Bills 2737, 3333, and 2847. Thank you, ma'am. Elizabeth, those three bills, and I understand that Representative Boquist has been working diligently on those. He is excused today to attend the service, funeral service of a colleague. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler, do you want me just to go through House Bill 2847A? Because that's what Representative Boquist
Please.
Wanted me to get amendment
yeah.
to, and then that combines some of the concepts then you're seeing in House Bill 3333 and then the 2737. So you have a dash A4 amendment. And it basically is deleting the original bill, so I'll just go, what you see and what the measure does is basically the amendment. So this is dealing with the charitable checkoff program. So we are specifying here some changes to the charitable checkoff program. And in particular, we're specifying that taxpayers be allowed the opportunity to select the Oregon Veterans Home or the Soldiers Family Relief Fund as a charitable checkoff on their personal income tax refund. And then it deletes the requirements under current law to have the $1 and $5 donation amounts printed on the tax return. And then it deletes the requirement that a charity must receive $50,000 or more in contributions in order to remain on the face of the tax form. So what we're doing is we're specifying in this bill what charities will be on the tax form and basically having a new procedure for that. So we will no longer have this having to get $50,000 or more in contributions in order to remain on the tax form. It allows a rotation of charities on the face of the personal income tax form, and I'll get into that in just a second. But it excludes the Oregon Veterans Home Account and Soldiers Family Relief Fund from the requirements in law for other charities to receive donations through this charitable checkoff system. It requires the Department of Revenue to include 8 spaces on the personal income tax form for taxpayers to donate their refund to charities. And it, first of all, it requires 4 spaces for the following charities, which are already on the face of the tax form, and or I should say 4 of them are, the Non-Game Wildlife Fund, Alzheimer's Disease Research Fund. There's also the Children's Trust and Endowment Fund that is currently not on the face of the tax form. That would be a new one added in. And the Stop Domestic and Sexual Violence. So those are 4 that would be on. Then you would have an additional 3 spaces there, which would be for AIDS, HIV, education and research, and this is one that is already under current law in the on the face of the form. They're one of those that has to get $50,000 or more in contributions each year in order to stay on the face. That requirement would be removed for them, and they would be on the face. And then you would have the Oregon Veterans Home Account, which is the new one that would be added on. The Oregon Veterans Home Account is in the instructions now, and contributions are given to it, but it's not on the face of the tax form. Then you would have the Soldiers Family Relief Fund. And then the last space, because, again, it said 8 spaces there, it specifies that last space then just be the other charities, which is the way it is now under current law, where they have other charities, and you can list the other charities and the amount you want to contribute. Then it's specifying that the amount taxpayers can donate of their tax refund is $10 or other. So those would be the only options, $10 or other. It then requires the Oregon Charitable Checkoff Commissions to produce annually to the Department of Revenue a list of the eligible charities to be included in the personal income tax instructions, and that's the same as what they do under current law. Now, this is a change, and this is something that I will check with Representative Boquist to make sure this is what he wanted to do, because I wasn't clear if this was what he wanted to do. But it is requiring then in biennium years a different procedure. These 8 spaces, like I just described, would be even numbered years. In the biennium years, you would have 12 spaces on the income tax form, and then you would have you would be deleting AIDS, HIV, Oregon Veterans Home, and Soldiers Family Relief, and then you would have 7 rotating spaces. And so the charities that are in the instructions, and you would have to be in the other category, would then be rotating. So you'd have 7 spaces on the form that would be in a rotating basis.
And if you get them all lined up, do you win something?
I know.
Is there a special prize?
Okay.
All
right.
Okay.
So basically, then it provides the Department of Revenue with rulemaking authority to establish when charities are rotated on the tax form. And then we have there, I say creates the Oregon Veterans Home Account, but actually when I looked again at Section 13, it doesn't create that Oregon Veterans Home Account. It just creates the Soldiers Fund, Relief Fund in the Oregon Military Department. So I would imagine that's just because you're going to be making charities to the Oregon Veterans Home. That would be distributed to the Oregon Veterans Home like the other, and that should be already established in law. Anyway, then it defines the purpose of the Oregon Soldiers Family Relief Program. And this, again, is the same as what we saw in particular House Bill 3333. Both House Bill 3333 and House Bill 2737 had these accounts set up to provide grants and loans to members of the Oregon National Guard, members of the reserves who are Oregon residents, spouses or dependents of a military person. And then it allows the military department the authority to establish rules for applying for a grant or loan and establishing eligibility to receive those grants or loans. Then it defines the purpose of the program to provide grants to members, basically, of the National Guard who have also been on active duty and have been wounded or injured. So that was that wounded and injured, those grants targeted was what was in House Bill 3333, where House Bill 2737 was a broader category of veterans and former active duty military. It allows the department to provide grants for housing, medical expenses, clothing, utilities, or other necessities of daily life. It establishes the Soldiers Family Relief Fund in the state treasury, continually then appropriates money from the Soldiers Family Relief Fund to the Oregon Military Department for the purpose of making these grants and loans to the soldiers. It applies to biennial years beginning on or after the effective date of this 2005 Act. So basically, what I also gave you, just so everyone has a little bit of background, is this sheet here on the charitable checkoffs and basically how much we've been using of this program. So from 1999 to 2003, those are all the actuals. And you can see, obviously, in 1997 to 1999, there were only five different charities listed on the face of the form, and that was it. And then we started in with the instructions in 2000. And then it has grown every year since. And so by 2003, we had 18 different charities, of which five were on the face with one other listed on the face. And as you can see, as the number of charities has grown, then the average overall has declined for the different charities. And you can see that the average charities on the face of the tax return, which is the second to last average column, a row there, you can see that over the course of the 6 years there, or 7 years, we see an average 20,956 people on average contribute to the charities on the face of the tax return, and they generate on average $122,155 for each one of those charities on the front face. And then you see that the average charities in the instructions, though, the number of contributors is only 855 people contributing per charity and $12,855 per charity. So there's a huge difference, obviously, from being on the face and being in the personal income tax return form versus being in the instructions. And so that's why this is the bill before you and really trying to expand the number that actually get in the instructions. And I think also Department of Revenue can talk about how easy it is to expand this form and whether or not they could fit 8 and then later 12 different charities there. And I did give you the form, too, just so everyone can see basically what we have under current law and the process we're taking now.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions for staff? Well, it's clear as mud, but at least it is for me. We'll work it out.
And just so everyone's clear, too, there is no revenue impact for, Oregon General Fund or local governments, but...
And there's no fiscal? There's no fiscal cost?
No, Deborah needs to speak to the fiscal cost
of this. Okay. Let's see. Representative Nelson, you're here. Representative Barnard, are you here on behalf of these bills, too? We've got all three of them opened up and concentrating on the... dash A4 to House Bill 2847 on the fiscal the revenue report, which was just given us from the committee, SMS. Representative Barnard, if you'd like to come forward, thank you very much. Representative Nelson, would you like to lead off, please?
Well, I'd like to, we're discussing 2847 and the dash 4 and
yes.
3333.
It's all rolled into it is what it is. Everything has been rolled in. Any of those... the amendments or the items on 3333 and 2737 have been rolled into the A4 amendments as have been discussed here today.
With a few changes.
Yeah, there are some changes.
Well, I think we need to call Representative Trepa because that was his bill. One of his bills was the 3333.
Well, as quickly as he's available, we will do that.
He's here.
Right. He's not available right at the moment.
Oh,
so
3333 and then the other one, please.
Okay. We are on. We've got open right now 3333, 2737, and we're discussing 2847 right now with the A4 amendments. So, Representative Krupp, did you want to lead off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. Mr. Chairman, I've looked over the amendments for this bill, and I'm fine with moving in the provisions that I had originally intended in my bill, House Bill 3333, of which I might mention Representative Nelson was also a co-chief sponsor. If this is the direction that is the chair and the committee's will, I'm okay with it.
Thank you very much, Representative Krupp. Representative Boquist has worked diligently on this, trying to, having served being a member of the Veterans Committee, trying to draw all these issues together as best he could without any significant revenue impact. So we'll just that's what we wanted to do here today was to try and get the information that we could. Recognizing that he is unavoidably absent today. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I might add that in regards to the concept of having the various entities listed on the front page of the 40S form, and then having seen this document here, which clearly shows that if you're not on the form, the face of the form, you don't get very much money. Mm-hmm. And I think that anyone who is here already would want to be on the face of the form, and I would certainly want these particular two opportunities to be on the face of that form also. So I know that causes some difficulty, I think, for the Department of Revenue in terms of how to accommodate all of those. I think at some point in time we have to probably make a decision to do so, and this is probably as good a time as any.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Krupp? Now, let's see. Representative Barnard, would you like to go ahead, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am reviewing the dash fours as we speak, and I'm looking particularly at page 11, where it appears as though the three bills have been neatly melded into one, and if I read it correctly, this allows the military department to establish regulations whereby they can make grants or loans from the Soldiers Family Relief Fund to members of the Oregon National Guard, members of the Reserve Forces of the United States who are residents of Oregon, members of the Guard or Reserve Forces who have been ordered to federal active duty, been wounded or injured, or the spouse or dependent of a person described in A, B, or C. In other words, those three items. And it looks to me, as I read that, as though this very neatly blends the bills. And I was going to talk about the differences between the bills, but I think that's irrelevant if you pass the dash fours to this bill and adopt this bill.
That would be our intention if we're able to get everything else to work out, Representative.
Right. And, Mr. Chair, the other comment that I had was really the one that Representative Krupp has already made about the checkoff. I believe that Representative Boquist had come up with Representative Boquist and Representative Kump had come up with a system that would allow for more items to appear on the face of Form 40 or Form 40S and would allow for a fair rotation of those. Now, that is a major policy shift for the committee and for the Department of Revenue, which I probably shouldn't say this, but which the committee ought to examine. I would support that policy shift, but I know there are members of the Assembly that do not.
Okay. And we will hear from the Department of Revenue because that probably has a fairly significant fiscal as well. So we'll come back to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those were the two comments that I had. And I really wanted to make certain that we had in the broader provisions of House Bill 2737, which appear to me are in the dash four.
And those,
and I'm getting a head nod from your staff.
Section 13, it appears that they're there. Representative Comp?
My comment would be is to confirm what Representative Barnhart is saying, and that Representative Boquist and I have met several times to and put these amendments in, you know, these try to pull these three bills together. And the only question that is remaining is what Elizabeth alluded to in her presentation is, I don't believe that cycle of how to rotate to create equity for the rest of the entities is quite worded right. But
okay.
The rest of it is really right.
Excellent.
Right on where we wanted it.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative Comp, were they wanting to delete those three during that period of time on the off years? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Or just rotate them?
Yeah, I think it was just a rotation. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think we need to look at a little bit of language
okay.
right there.
And Representative, for the record, let's see, it appears that we've got most of that committee here right now with Representative Nelson, Comp, and Barnhart, and then Boquist is a member of, Representative Boquist is a member of this committee, but absent there. Yes, Representative.
Well, one final comment, if I may, just to make sure we're not missing. The Committee on Veterans Affairs held a number of hearings at which issues that are related to these three bills trying to figure out a way to fund these items was an issue for us, because we believe that taking care of the things that are specified in these bills in the A4s is very important in the process of taking care of our soldiers while they're deployed, and also very important in the process of taking care of our troops as they return and as they try to return to a regular civilian life. We expect there to be significant issues around that adjustment and the changes that are needed, especially in dealing with wars like the war in Iraq, where there's a long campaigns, long period of time of deployment in dangerous situations, and a return to civilian life, especially for the National Guard troops, with very modest involvement on the part of the federal government in helping people with making those adjustments. I personally believe that a successful programs in these areas that we've been talking about here, and the ones that Representative Krupp and I especially were working on, will go a long way toward reducing our costs long term, and in reducing a lot of human suffering on the part of our soldiers returning and on the part of their families. Of course, as is always the case, when you have people who are returning are able to act as competent, active, energetic adults in the society, you also have a positive effect on revenues as opposed to a negative effect. But that's a side effect, not the primary effect we're after.
Thank you.
On the last piece, the home has demonstrated a significant need, and we don't have the funds to pay for it.
Representative Berger is recognized.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm deeply appreciative. We've got a lot of the Veterans Committee here to explain this, and so let me kind of, because this is my first look, and it's three bills that are melded into one, and it's very complicated. So, but let me sort of get a sense of the way the committee is trying to put this all together. Representative Barnhart has been very articulate in the needs that we're trying to address here, and believe me, I share your sense of the needs of our returning troops and their families and what we're all faced with in this state and long term. In addressing that, however, what you've come up with is a fund through the military department that, correct me if I'm wrong, staff or anybody, would be different than the usual charitable checkoff, which is an independent charity, not in any way state associated other than on this list. But what we're talking about here is a state under the Treasury fund, So it is a new animal. Am I correct in that?
You're correct.
All right. And you're doing this by way of finding a way to fund this need that you guys have been grappling with and basically trying, you know, the need's there. How could we fund it and by what mechanism? And this is basically the way that you're trying to address all this. Have I put this together? You're nodding. Madam Chair, are you nodding?
Yes, kind of.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh.
First of all, I just want to clarify, I don't know if Representative Butler knows I'm on the Trade and Economic Development Committee.
So you've been through this several times,
huh? Several. But on the Veterans Committee, but on the previous bill, I want you to know that. I don't know if you knew that. That's why I was here. Okay. For that bill. Haven't worked very hard to get that bill supported. I don't know. This is a first time for me. I did not know we were doing this as chair of the committee. I was not aware we were meshing these, melding all these bills together. There is no need to do so.
Representative, we're in public hearing on these, and you're welcome to go ahead and advance whatever kinds of things that you'd like to do. This was Representative Boquist's best shot at trying to get these put together in such a fashion to try and blend the all issues into one bill. And as you're well aware, we're down to the 24-hour rule now, and the time is ticking off pretty fast. So my hope was that we'd be able to come to some kind of consensus on one of these three bills, to meld them together, to get the things into one particular bill, and put all of that weight in one and shoot that volley across the floor and get it into the Senate. Now, if you want to go ahead and try and work all three bills, we're welcome to do that. But Representative Boquist will have to start all over, and he won't be back until Monday morning.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can appreciate that. You know, what concerns me is these are three different, totally different issues, and that I don't feel that this is the place. For us to put a lot of these things all together. One is a military family relief fund. One is a home that needs to be supported that needs $300,000 of repairs today. We gave them $1 as long as I've been here in the legislature, and we didn't pay them that. We get out of the committee. The other one, if it's depending on which bill the other one is it 30? If it's 33-33?
Yes.
It is a different one, the Wounded Soldier Relief Program. So... they're called totally different things than the bills that were passed through the House. I could not represent that we passed this bill that you have this amendment for. I'm very supportive of the work, but I think it's very confusing just hearing Elizabeth read it. Made me, you know, feel like I was on some merry-go-round. So, whirling. So I think we've complicated this. I need to say I was the one who started the issue on the checkable checkoff issue. Worked with the Department of Revenue to come up with a way to move all these, however many there are, 30 of them, these benefits in a equal way on a regular basis to rotate them. So that's how we got into that. Let's rotate them all. Let's not have any $50,000 requirements to stay on the front page. Or let's put all of them on one page. It would be better to have every one of them, you know, on the second page than just a few, because you see from the statistics it's, you know, you get it's $120,000 or it's, you know, $15,000, depending if you're on the second page.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to run way out of time here very shortly. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to respond very briefly to one of the issues that I think Representative Berger raised, and that is that we chose the military department as the one to administer these funds because we believe that they're the ones who are best able to decide which applications are valid and which ones ought to be funded.
And that's who does this in this bill.
Yeah, that's correct. Right. And that's the reason for choosing them rather than some alternate person. Okay. They have direct access to the command structure, and those who want to apply from the regular service army or from the reserves can do so through their command structure. These are the people who work with this day in and day out, and they're the ones who are most able to make appropriate decisions about the distribution of funds. And that's the reason we set it up that way.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I need to explain this to you. The Veterans Home program is already under the jurisdiction of the Department of Veteran Affairs.
Yes.
Not the military department.
Right. Thank you very much. We've got about 20 minutes, and we've got several more people here and five more bills. Thank you, Representative. I'll call Colonel Mike Caldwell forward, and then Paula Brown.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. Might be real short. Clearly the committee is trying to meld something together to get something that works. The bills are good. We support them. And we think the effort by the Veterans Committee is outstanding to try to address some of these issues. And I'll let Deputy Director Brown talk about the Veterans Home.
Okay, thank you very much. Could you be brief, Paula? We're totally out of time now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. There's really only one issue that I want to raise concerning this bill today, and it is the reference to the Oregon Veterans Home account. It's truly an oversight on the department's part in not having brought this up to the House Veterans Affairs Committee. We appreciate the good work that they did. We did, after that committee had passed the bill out of committee, realize that the reference to Oregon Veterans Home account may not have been the true intentions of those who had started this. The way the monies work in the Oregon Veterans Home account, there is a means test by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. We are concerned that this, having the funds go into that account, could create a situation where there would be a loss of federal dollars, and just wanted to bring that up. We have made some, we do have some recommendations that we believe would take care of that. Yes, we do.
Okay.
The funds would simply go into the trust fund instead of the Veterans Home account.
A member of Representative Boquist's staff is here today. Perhaps you could share that information.
Absolutely.
With that staff member, and then we might be able to resolve that. And if you'll work with Representative Nelson, Representative Boquist's office, maybe we can sort that out in another amendment to, in addition to the A4.
Would be happy to do that.
All right.
Chair.
Thank you very much, Paula. And I am going to bring Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue. I'm anxious to get just a brief feel for the fiscal. Deborah, when we start moving numbers around from one form to another and lines, and particularly when we've got new additions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your experience in the tax preparation field. I'm handing out three forms. One is the Form 40-S. Currently, what is on the short form for the charitable checkoff program, you will see in the blue box at the bottom there are six lines now. What concerns me, Mr. Chairman, in the Dash A4 amendments is that the department is mandated to put 8 charities on the form in the beginning, and then I believe 4 years from now we would be required to put 12 on the form without any leeway to leave them off if there isn't space, which we have in current law. Currently, we can tell the commission how much space is available, and then they tell us which charities are to be listed, and we think that's very important to have that. Occasionally, Mr. Chair, the legislature changes the law and it impacts the tax forms, and we're required to make changes. When we had Measure 30 on the ballot, we had to remove one line in order to get a surcharge line on there. You can see on line 8 of this form, we have one line to report wages, unemployment, interest, and dividends. That's one of the changes we made in order to accommodate.
Does this make everything really, really tiny?
Mr. Chairman, it's just about there, I think. So, in fact, We took one line off the other credits line, and we had a lot of negative feedback from that change because people then weren't able to take the political contribution credit and use this form. They had to go to Form 40. So we had negative feedback on that. We just need some flexibility, Mr. Chair. If you tell us we want you to maximize the entities that appear here, we're happy to do that. If you tell us take off these boxes and only have another line, we will do that. Yeah. But we do need enough flexibility that we can accommodate the tax administration.
I'm going to have Representative Berger just briefly share with you just one potential idea here.
Deborah, it's come to me that what the Veterans Committee is proposing is something slightly different than all of the other organizations that basically have been on this form, and one that has a state need to serve a specific state need. I don't know how else to put it. So what would be the result of putting this new fund on the front as a checkoff with a reference underneath it to other charitable checkoffs are available, and all of those would be listed in the booklet. So you would basically retune it to one on the face, ours, if you will,
yeah,
our vets. All the rest,
which are nonprofit,
which are not associated directly with the military department or the state of Oregon, but are all worthy charities. And we know the dynamic here. Every charity wants on this list. And it would basically equalize all of them in the booklet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we would have no problem with that. We have no problem with listing any of them on. It's simply that occasionally there isn't room to do what everyone wants us to do. So if you were to put on the Veterans Home or another one specific entity on the form and then have just the other charity line,
other
that
charity
would actually free up four lines.
Yeah. Other charity and the reference to the the other charity reference and some line that indicates that there is a list of eligible charities in the booklet or something that says that they're there. So we haven't basically cut them out of the front entirely, but simply the only one would, or possibly two, that are state sponsored, if you will, charities for our veterans would be the only ones then listed actually on the front of the form.
So for lack of a better, and let me see if I could say this, those things that would normally have been funded from the general fund, the Veterans Home account or the Soldiers Family Relief Fund, those things which would normally have come from the general fund as opposed to the Stop Domestic Violence or HIV AIDS education research programs, those kinds of programs could then be listed. They would all be listed, just not on the face of the return. You'd have a spot for those that are general fund programs on the face, and then they can pick up the other off of a credit line on similar to what you have on line 30 on the S right now.
Mr. Chairman, as the form currently exists, we would have room to do that. And I did give you a copy of how those instructions look now, the listings in.
Representative Berger, please go ahead.
I expect that as a result of this, every charity listed here is going to be in my office within moments. I am prepared for that.
Mr. Chairman, may I just add one thing? You asked about the fiscal impact. If we're required to list 12 entities and we're required to add another page to the form, we would add four pages to the booklet. The cost would be $100,000 to do that.
$100,000 for four pages.
Because we cannot add only one page. The way our printing works, we have to add four. It would be $100,000 cost to add four pages to the booklets.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you print pictures in there, too? I might want one.
You bet.
We could fill out the four pages.
Could you, Mr. Chair?
Yes,
could I please ask Deborah, if you go back to page, 29 or 34 in the booklet, you see all the other charities listed.
Yes, that's on the handout, page 12 on the S.
Yeah.
40S.
So this is what we were saying. If you want fair playing ground for everybody, you can either put all of them, you know, listed on one page,
right,
or rotate.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2847, 3333, and House Bill 2737. Looks like we've got some folks that will be working together with the representative and the representative's office. And, Representative Berger, perhaps you could also meet with Representative Boquist when he gets back with those suggestions.
And, as I said, I expect there'll be a lot of people in my
office.
Well,
the only thing that cries out for a change is a baby with a wet diaper. So, anyway. Okay. We'll continue on. Then with, excuse me while I reorganize here. We've got then a House Rent Resolution 34A. We'll open a public hearing on 34A. We've had a...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, welcome to the more exciting part of your program tonight.
Yes. This is great, Mazen. Good.
Okay.
Give me some soft shoe.
The last time we talked about this House resolution, you adopted two amendments. You adopted the A9 and the A10. And what they have done basically is dedicate, rather than 1.5, 1% of lottery proceeds to veteran issues that are also dedicated within the bill itself or within the resolution itself into different funds. So we've worked all these amendments into one. You have the A11 in front of you. And the A11 does exactly what we have in the A9 and the A10 put together and working in that way. The revenue impact statement of the A11 also is in front of you. What it shows the fiscal year 06 and 07 are not impacted because the program kicks in July 07. That will be fiscal year 08. That year will have about 5.10 on the total, 5.10 million. With the different programs, the first one is the Veterans Service Officers getting 50% of that. That's 2.55, and then going down with the 5% increments and allowing 3% administration leaves you with the 20%, 27% at 1.38 to be distributed within the programs that were mentioned before. As deemed appropriate by the director of the department. In biennial terms, that will be about $10.4 million for the 07-09 biennium and about $11.3 in the 09-11. And that primarily comes and, well, actually reduces by the same amount the discretionary appropriation that is available to the legislature today.
Thank you. Questions of staff? We have Linn County Commissioner John Lindsay and Jeff Hill and Doug McClellan. McClellan. I'm sorry, Representative Nelson. I beg your pardon. Did you want to start? I beg your pardon. You were there, and I just...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've got enough experts here to handle the amendments. I've not seen any of them. I didn't even know that they were being drafted.
On this... Let's see. House Joint Resolution 34?
Right.
Okay. I think we've got dash A11. Okay. Okay. Lynn County Commissioner John Lindsay, Jeff Hill, McElrin, Doug McElrin. Good.
For the record, my name is Jeff Hill. I'm a member of the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association and the County Veterans Service Officer for Washington County. And I'd like to say that the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers are in support of House Joint Resolution 34 and the amendments, as it provides stable funding to the veterans services and services to the Oregon National Guard. We would like to suggest a clarification in the language in one section, I think to meet the desired intent of the bill, and that is on the version I have in front of me. It was on the fourth page, line 9. It was to it specifically states service officers provided by veteran services officers in Oregon. As to the funding, we would like to suggest that it would read, for clarification, veteran service officers accredited through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. When you just state veteran service officers, there's a lot of individuals out there who, through their local posts or other agencies, can call themselves veteran service officers that do not have the training that a county veteran service officer has or a person who is employed by the Oregon Department of Veterans Services has. So for clarification, we would just recommend that bit of language change.
Okay, which line is that on? Is that on the A11?
That's on the engrossed.
Engrossed, okay.
The engrossed version of the bill from the last page.
On the last page.
Would be line 9, Representative Butler.
Yeah, please. Members, those of you who are here, we're just going to ask for excuse up on the floor so that we can try and get through the rest of this agenda. Okay, Matt, do you have the recommended changes?
No, I don't, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. I just...
Director Vinny.
I'm going to give those to us again and reference it now to the line.
It would be line 9 on page 4 of the A in gross.
Okay.
We would recommend that the language be changed to services provided by veteran service officers accredited through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay.
I'm at the A in gross.
Okay, so accredited through. Is that accredited?
Accredited. Through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay. Okay, so that would be yet another amendment. Anything further?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. And again, your name was?
Jeff Hill.
Jeff Hill. Okay, thank you, Jeff. Any questions of Jeff? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mr. McElrin, is he here?
I went ahead and condensed our testimony.
Okay, so he won't be showing up then. John?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Representative Butler. As you might have seen, I'm kind of the one that had the talk with Representative Boquist and also the director of ODVA to introduce this type of referral to the voters.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, we need a signature.
For the record,
John Lindsay from Lynn County. The main reason I'm here is just in case you have any questions, but as I was sitting listening to some of the earlier stuff, a couple of thoughts had entered my mind, and kind of the reasoning, and this would be appropriate in this committee to address this, is how we came about to this. There were some questions brought up, and I know that the reason we're in front of the Revenue Committee is whether there would be any kind of negative impacts as to anything else. So I can tell you, as also an elected official,
anytime someone comes up in front of me and says, I want this funded, a lot of times we'll reply back to them, okay, where are we going to take the money from to do this? And I think this is a prime example of something that was misestimated several years ago, and that there are running surpluses. So there is the money there, but we need voter approval to transfer that money. We had gone over this very much in front of the Veterans Affairs Committee, Representative Nelson's committee, and reviewed a lot of this. Other than that, unless you have any specific questions, I did not plan on talking very much about this issue. I will note that the Line 9 service officer's suggestion that was just said, I was not aware of that until just seconds ago about that. I do remember that in long consultation with the director of VODDA, we had talked very much about how that line would be worded. And it had something to do with veteran service officers in the employment office and also the county veteran service officers to make sure that we covered those subjects. I don't know if this would cover what Jim Wallace from the ODDA.
So while you went through Veterans Affairs, this issue didn't come up?
No. Originally, when this was first drafted, I remember the wording was slightly different, and we changed it. Now, I was just told that Representative Boquist agreed to this. So I'm assuming, because Representative Boquist was also in on that conversation, that this will solve that problem of ambiguity, who is a veteran service officer.
Okay. And, Matt, so far as you can see in this dash 11, it's not included in that.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Further questions for Mr. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass is recognized.
What was the thinking on the changing of the allocation to parks?
To try and thumbnail sketch, I guess part of the thought is for one, you have different hats that you wear in your life. I too am also a veteran and have been very involved with veterans issues varying for some 15 years now. At the same time, I'm also a county commissioner, and so I see the world from that view too. And I guess it comes down to some stuff that came out of the last legislative session, culmination of different issues that popped up in front of some committees and budgeting last session. Now, from experience as a veteran, I know that we're going to have a problem in this state in the next few years. There is a problem that is about ready to compress on us. As a veteran that saw that experience from the Gulf War, we know that some problems had come up with returning veterans, and quite frankly, those issues were never addressed for several years out. And if they were addressed in the front, to be frank, there might be people still alive today. We don't know. Because there was a failure of legislative bodies to act fast enough to make sure that these people get the services that they need. Now, as seeing that to the forefront, coming back to my role as a commissioner, I know that coming forward, we need to have a stabilized source of revenue for these actions to take place. And so, after reviewing it, I know that in these particular allocations of funds, that we do have rolling surpluses. And interesting enough, I do have a couple of figures here that even if the voters approved Measure 34, taking one fund in example, OWEB, they would still be able to have their 21% increase in funding for the 05-07 year. They would still be projected at a 12% increase for 07-09, and they would still receive a 22% projected increase for 09-011. Now, when another official, I sit here and I look at a budget that we know the numbers would have grown over the last several years, I'm going, it would be very nice if certain other budgets could grow at that kind of rate. So I don't really see this as, taking a hit to an individual. What it is we had a misprojection on the original ballot measure 66 before video poker took off and the rest of the lottery, and we had this enormous growth. That those figures that the voters actually looked at were not what has transpired since that time. And we do have excessive monies in those accounts. And I don't see it as something that really damages anybody.
and only enhances a need that we know is going to be there over the next few years.
Well, I was just wondering, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes, follow
up. How you got the 5644? Is that just because you looked at the percentages of recent budgets? And
okay, now I believe that was an amendment.
That's in the A11 on
right.
3 and 4.
And that, Representative Hass, I am not familiar with the internal of that amendment.
I'm not suggesting there's anything nefarious. I was just
right.
curious as to where that came from.
I'm only associated with the 13.5%.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Lindsay. We did have Paula Brown signed up on this, but I have another representative that I'm holding off the floor. Paula, did you have something that you needed to add now at this time?
I'm
holding up a state representative off the floor, so
I will follow.
Why don't we do this? I'm going to temporarily.
Actually, I can answer that question too.
So you're involved in this one as well as the next budget?
Just because I was on the committee, I know the answer to Representative Hass's question.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Hunt.
For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County, that Representative Boquist arrived at that amount because he was trying to keep the salmon piece whole. So by adjusting that to 56%, there would be no cut for the salmon programs from the current funding level. So the entire hit would be taken only by the parks piece of it, because there's a fairly significant surplus in that piece. That was his intent.
Okay. And Representative Hunt, you're here to testify on behalf of
2945.
And so let's see what we do. We just go ahead and just open up 2945. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing on 2945 contemporaneously with the House Joint Resolution 34. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for taking me early. Again, State Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. If you look at House Bill 2945, there are actually very few words here, but it's actually fairly confusing in language. So let me try and break it down. There are really three types of veterans that would qualify for this property tax exemption. And as you look at the numbers here, the dollars are not the amount they get, and the dollars listed are not the amount they get to deduct off their taxes. The dollars are only the amount that they may exempt from taxation. So if you have a $100,000 house, you may currently take $8,750 off of that value and then apply the property tax that applies. But really three different types of veterans. One are service-connected veterans, and you'll see those listed down at the very bottom of page one. They currently get an exemption of $11,670, as it says in statute. Although you also notice that at the very end of the bill, there's already an inflation adjuster in for that exemption that's equal to 103%. So even the numbers in here are a little deceptive. If in line 28, where you see that $11,670, because that's already been adjusted for several years at 3% increase a year, today that's already about $14,000. This bill would increase that amount to $18,000. So from the current about $14,000 up to $18,000. And then because of the 3% adjustment that's already in there, it would continue to be adjusted over time. The rationale being that's very low, and these again are service-connected veterans who have a 40% or greater disability that was caused by their service. Second category is those without a service-connected disability. They are still disabled, but it's not service-connected. And that really breaks down into the second and third category. If you are certified, as you can see in line 9 through 11, certified by the Department of Veterans Affairs, then you automatically qualify for this exemption. And you'll see currently it's listed at $8,750. Because that's already been adjusted for inflation over time, today, as I understand it, that's about $11,000. So again, this would up it from the current $11,000 up to $15,000. And the last category you'll see under sub B there in line 12, those who are certified to have a disability. They are disabled veterans, but they haven't yet got their DVA rating. And if you've heard about some of the delays at Department of Veterans Affairs hospitals, that's increasingly becoming a problem in getting the DVA rating. So they say they're disabled. A physician has said they're disabled, but they have to meet a means test until they get their DVA rating. And so you'll see the means test is listed today in lines 19 and to 24 at a series of dollar figures that have been fixed in statute for a lot of years and never adjusted for inflation. This bill would change that, so it would increase it somewhat up to 185% of the federal poverty level, which for an individual is about $17,705, I believe, this year. And then it would, by being tied to the federal poverty level, it would continue to be adjusted for inflation, so it would never have to come back before this committee again, would be the intent. Two goals: increase these numbers somewhat in terms of the exemption, increase the means test to include more veterans who are still very low income, and then tie it to an inflation factor so we deal with it permanently.
Dave, give me the mechanism of how the means test is weighed in with the county assessor's office.
How the means test is evaluated, how they evaluate it?
Who does the certification of the means testing and the adjusting of the values?
That is an excellent question, Mr. Chair. That is done today based on the dollar figures that are fixed in statute. So whatever the mechanism is would not change, but I do not know the answer to that.
There's some sort of certification that people must make they presently meet the mean or presently meet the means test,
right,
and they are presently a veteran.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and again, that does not include the service-connected vets, and that does not include the disabled vets who are certified by the Department of Veterans Affairs. So it's the means test only applies to that fairly narrow pool that's left.
All right. Questions for Representative Hunt? Thank you, Representative. We still have House Senate Resolution 34, and let's see. We're down to Paula Brown. Paula, back on 34. We'll temporarily close 2945. We'll come back to it. Mac, what's that Mac there, too?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I know that Representative Boquist, Commissioner Lindsay, Jim Willis, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, worked extensively on the language for HJR 34. I believe that the -A11 amendments meet exactly what they had intended to accomplish. I would suggest that to confirm that, the committee could certainly confirm that with Representative Boquist. He did a very good job in putting the information together and testifying on this bill previously. And we would have concerns if the suggestion from the previous that testified were included in the -11 amendments, because I believe that the intent is that it would include all veteran service officers, including the national service officers for the veterans organizations, the county veteran service officers, and the department staff. And I believe in Representative Boquist's testimony before another committee, he articulated that using the terminology accredited by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs would exclude a number of veteran service officers, including some county veteran service officers who are unable to be accredited because they do not meet working the minimum number of hours to be accredited. So,
smaller counties could be affected by that.
That's absolutely correct, Mr. Chair. And I'll keep my testimony very brief. That would be my only comments. I appreciate everybody's work on it. Representative Boquist has done a terrific job, and I believe the -A11 meets exactly the intent of those who worked on the bill.
So I need some help, Paula. How many of the 36 county services veterans office directors in all of the 36 counties are presently accredited by the Oregon DVA?
I don't have that number. I don't have that number with me, but I could certainly provide that to you by the end of the day. I have that number.
Yeah, should have that for the record. If you'll provide that for the record.
I will do
that. I think that would be important county by county that we'd like to know that information.
I'd be happy to provide that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mac?
Representative, all the members of the committee, I represent the various veterans organizations.
For the record, Mac?
For the record, my name is Matt McDonald, representing Oregon Veterans, American Legion, VFW, Disabled American Veterans, ex-POWs, Purple Heart, Military Order of American Officers, Military Order of World Wars. We don't want to see any changes to the proposed amendment. We do not want our national service officers that are certified by the National Department of Veterans Affairs eliminated from this, and that's exactly what would happen if you picked up that proposed amendment. There are 9 veteran service officers, primarily in the Portland area, that would be eliminated, and we do not want to see them eliminated from this.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to your statement here. I don't know what a service officer, veteran service officer is, and if there is no statutory definition, my only concern would be somebody could put, I'm a service officer, on their business card and therefore be eligible for these funds. Do you have that concern?
I do not have that concern, Representative Berger, because the only ones we recognize are the national service officers, the state service officers, and the county service officers. Other people may help veterans, but they're not service officers under our understanding. And we don't believe that anybody in authority would think anyone else was.
Okay.
Those are the only people that are recognized by the veterans organizations and recognized by the Department of Veterans Affairs and recognized by the federal government.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Mazin.
This is a constitutional amendment, so once this is in the Constitution, it means somebody needs to define it.
Yeah.
Because it's...
You
can't have the constitutional language not completely...
Sounds like you've got 3 different kinds that may be roving all over there at that particular point. This is Representative Boquist's amendment, and I assume that the dash 11 did come from Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, this dash A11 came from the committee. Remember, you adopted A9 and A10,
right,
and the A11 became that.
Okay. So did we work this? Did we work 9 and 10?
We did work 9 and 10, and... And the A9 goes A9 and A10,
right?
And then we took them and we adopted them, and as a result of their adoption, they became meshed together into the A11.
Okay. And at this particular point, at this time, there is a proposal to change that yet with one more piece of information. And I'm going to let that be the purview of Representative Boquist when he returns. He's left us some notes on this dated the 6th when they last heard this. So let's see. The only other person I had that was signed up here, Paula Brown, we've got. And Jeff, tell us again who you were with. I didn't get that for the record. Okay. County Vets Service. Okay. And we'll get you there, John. Okay. Did you have further testimony, John?
It's okay, just for a moment.
Yeah, okay, fine. We're holding everybody off the floor for this, so
Representative Butler, again, I just want to reiterate, I had not seen these A11 amendments. I would just like to make it on the record that I'm adamantly opposed to this.
Adamantly opposed to the A11.
The A11 amendment will not, because of the redistribution form inside OWEB and Parks, will violate the single subject rule. This will not stand up in court. I'm just going by record of how many times we've been sued and on various ballot measures. It's just violating.
Are you a lawyer?
No, but I just know that that just went into refinancing of 2 different other departments, and if we get into there, we have too many subjects we're dealing with.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Lindsay. So we add one more item to the list.
Mr. Chair, the The A9 dealt with this issue.
And the A10?
And the A10 did the distribution.
Okay.
So we're no longer going into Parks part of the pot and slicing that and then establishing a new clause. So you would have two issues to deal with, but rather only one. So Parks is out of the discussion here, and we only have a 1% dedication to veterans. And that is a single subject issue. That
and that's what the A11 does, is it separates out the Parks portion of it.
Yes, it leaves Parks' portion just as it is today, the Constitution, so it's not touching it anymore.
Okay.
And it takes the 1%, and what it does, it splits the 1% amounts into different funds.
That still doesn't address the definitional issues that have come up from the testimony from Jeff Hill and the concerns of Mac McDonald and others.
Yes. Before all this is over, we have to have a constitutional...
Or
as languages defining what the constitutional definitions
are. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 34. Thank you very much, and I'm going to open up. We're open for a public hearing on 2945, so we will continue the public hearing on 2945. I have Kevin O'Reilly signed up, Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. Welcome, Mr. O'Reilly. Why don't we have staff go ahead and tell us what this, where we're at on 2945.
Okay. This bill, 2945 A. M. Grost, will increase the tax exemption for qualified disabled veterans and modifies the eligibility requirement for a property tax exemption. The exemption amount is changed to $15,000 of assessed value for a disabled veteran and $18,000 for a veteran with a service-related disability. The modified eligibility requirement is that the income of the veteran, and I stand corrected. I had thought household income, but as the bill reads, it's actually the veteran's income may not exceed 185% of the federal poverty guidelines, and that is what's been proposed and explained to you with testimony. And as you know from current law, the exemption amount is increased annually by 103%, or 3%. The exemption amount for 0405 is currently about $10,000 for disabled veterans and $13,005 for veterans with service-related disabilities. In FY03-04, roughly 37,000 qualified veterans or their spouses received the average exemption of $12,000. The tax expenditure report published by the Department of Revenue for 2005-07 indicates that the revenue loss attributable to this exemption in 03-05 was $12.9 million, while the anticipated loss for 05-07 is about $13.7
million. And that's the...
That's under current law.
That would be that's the total reduction in property tax, both the local millage as well as the state millage.
Correct,
that's
Mr.
the school millage.
Correct, Mr.
Education.
Chair.
Estimated to be for the current at $12.9 million and $13.7 million for the next biennium.
Current law. And I do not have a revenue impact at this point. However, based on the testimony and the reading, I'd have to look at the differences, but I haven't yet adjusted the reports. I don't believe the expenditure report reflects more than a 3% increase in the valuation from 0305 to 0507 on an annualized basis.
So that's why the 0305 is not significantly greater than the...
Correct.
I guess the 0507 is not significantly greater than 0305. You don't anticipate...
Well, in the expenditure report, I don't believe it's reflecting any possible increase in the number of eligibles, and so I'm going to be checking before I do an impact analysis on this.
Okay, all right. Mr. O'Reilly, thank you for coming forward, and I apologize for holding on.
Quite all right. Good afternoon, Chair Butler, members of the committee. My name is Kevin O'Reilly. I'm here representing the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. I'll keep this short and sweet. We support the bill. We are particularly fond of raising the means test for the low-income veterans. We feel this would be a good benefit, helping these veterans with incidental health care costs, which are going up much faster than other forms of inflation. any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. Questions for?
Well, I had a question for Mary. When you said, could you just clarify what you were saying in terms of household income versus?
Yes, I had thought that it's in both the current and the proposed legislation, the income requirement will be based on the individual veteran's income, not household income. I misread the bill because it got down to the current law where the eligibility requirement is based in part upon the number of people in the household, but it's, and it adjusted for that, right? But in actuality, it's based on his individual income.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. I think that's, you guys, thank you for your service to our country. when will you have some information relative to the?
I would say by Monday.
Okay. Well, we're under the 24-hour rule, so I guess we could bring it back after Monday then. And then the last person I had was Representative Nelson. Is she going to come back, or is she offended to the point where she won't come back, Robin, at this point? I'm sorry that I guess I overlooked her at the very first of the last session. And okay, with that, we will close the works or the public hearing on 2945, and we'll move on to 3334. We'll open a public hearing on 3334, Mary.
Okay. 3334, A.N. Grossed, grants a property tax exemption of up to $60,000 of assessed value. I'll give you a summary sheet to follow. To members of the military who are mobilized in support of war efforts, or actually to members of the military. The dash 2, A2 amendment clarified that the intent of the bill was to really focus on those members of the military that had been mobilized in support of the war. In order to accomplish that, the language that reads 30 days on the Section 1 of the bill had to be changed to 178 days, and Representative Boquist explained the reason for that in the testimony. The difference in the revenue impact is enormous. The original estimate I prepared several months ago was almost $8.9 million for 0507, and the current estimate is less than $300,000. We're dropping the number of eligibles for this incredibly. The dash 3 and 4, which you have before you, I don't know, wasn't important to give it to you because the language was incorrect as I reviewed it, and that those were rescinded. And the dash 5 replaces is really the next amendment in order that you really have to look at. Okay. And the dash 5 was the clarification that Representative Boquist and Representative Comp worked on in order to clarify the language a little bit, and there is no substantive change that I could see from it. When you really, I can cite the changes, but they really are minor.
So the dash five is the work of Representative Boquist and Comp together then?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And the A2 amendment?
The A2 is the one that we actually looked at originally.
Previously.
And that is the one that shows 178 days in it.
Okay. But that's been resolved in the A5s?
It's resolved. 178 days replaces the original A engrossed bill that had 30 days in it.
Okay, but I see here in the in the A5 that 178 consecutive days is in the A5 as well.
That's correct.
So it's the A5 resolves the issues both in A2 as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Both have 178 day provision in them.
All right.
And A5 is just a clarification of other words, one of which, for example, was the use of next of kin instead of qualified person who can live in the home.
So at that point, the A2, A3, A4 would not be considered because the issues are in A5. And do we have a fiscal or a revenue impact on the A5?
Yes, $0.29 million in 0507 and $0.31 million in 0709.
Yes, clarification.
That is the what you're saying is that the fiscal impact statement that is in the A2 sheet is the same as the fiscal impact statement for the A5.
That is correct, Representative Gruber. It should be.
All right, now, where does that show that fiscal?
On the revenue statement, revenue impact statement.
I have it right here.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to find that. I've got the...
That one, which should say, well, I don't think we recopied it because there was no substantive changes.
Okay, well, I thought I had everything that had been handed out to us.
I'm not sure that we actually recopied the A2 and changed it to an A5. I've been told if there's no changes, then we can go with the...
Give that to you, Mr. Chair, since I have a copy.
Well, I'm wondering why.
Let's do it for me.
No, no, that's fine.
It says A and that's the A2. Yeah.
But there is a significant difference between those two.
There was a significant difference in the population, Mr. Chair.
So 310,000 is the 0709 and 290,000 is the 0507 revenue impact. And that's the total of the revenue relative to the all property taxes collected.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Both the local millage as well as the education millage.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's see, we have Colonel Caldwell signed up here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and I would like to support this particular piece of legislation. I think it would add a lot to the numerous National Guardsmen and Army other reserve components that have been called from active duty. The key component in this is leaving Title 32 status, going to Title 10 status, if you notice in the bill in the A5. What that really says is that you're a traditional guardsman or a citizen soldier, and then you're being called to federal active duty. In many instances, these folks are called, and they take substantial economic impacts on their standard of living in order to serve their country. So we support the bill and would ask that you do the same.
Thank you very much, Colonel Caldwell. Questions for Colonel Caldwell? Thank you very much, Colonel. So, colleagues, it appears that what we're considering then is that we'll be considering the A5 amendments, and the revenue impact for the current biennium is $290,000 on all property taxes. Counties don't, counties, cities, special districts, they don't, for $290,000, they don't come forward, huh?
What's the bill?
Okay. Just one. Wondered what their tolerance was for how many feathers you got to pluck before they come rushing out.
I can't wait to hear from all those
counties. Yeah, you're going to hear from the charities, but I'll probably hear from the counties. Okay. The only other person that signed up for 3334 was Representative Nelson. Not on it. Okay. I guess
on the floor.
On the floor. Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on 3334 and open a public hearing on 2933. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2933, it's A engrossed, but we also have an A2 amendment. So the A2 is what you really need in order to get at what is the measure in the measure description.
And who brings us the A2 amendment?
Oh, Representative Boquist and I had a discussion about this. So, you know, this really does do what was originally, I guess, talked about in the last committee meeting when they had it in the other committee, which was, I don't know if it was Veteran Affairs or if it was just, I guess it came from, Veteran Affairs. So anyway, you have to look at the details of the bill, and that wasn't done in the last time with this amendment. So this amendment, the A2, deletes the A and gross bill. It specifies that basically the outstanding personal income tax liability would be eliminated for military personnel who die while on active duty since September 11, 2001. And this is what Representative Boquist wanted to do. He wanted to basically give a benefit to the families of the military that pass away since September 11, 2001. There's like 41 deaths and stuff. So it's clarifying that the outstanding personal income tax liability, interest, and penalties that would be eliminated is just for the tax years in which the military personnel had been performing military service. And it allows the taxpayer to amend tax returns until December 31st, 2006, and provides military personnel with the ability to defer personal income taxes for 6 months after they return to Oregon from being on active military duty. So the last portion really will not have a revenue impact because basically you're just allowing military personnel to defer their personal income taxes. This would be eventually paid. So the revenue loss is just from any outstanding tax liability that would have been accrued during that time period that they were serving overseas. And
Look,
so,
Jeff, I hate to interrupt you. We're needed on the floor.
You're needed.
We'll close House Bill, the public hearing on 2933. We'll close House Revenue for today.
All right.